Well, I've said this before, but it's worth saying again that it's always an incredible privilege to have Professor Amartya Sen at LSE. And having Professor Sen at LSE is a little bit like having a rock star in on campus. The queues around the block, you're begging, people are begging for tickets and disappointed faces and people crying. So it is, but this evening, on behalf of the South Asia Center, I'm Mukulika Banerjee, I'm the director. It gives me enormous pleasure to invite Professor Sen to release a new edition of a classic book that many of you here will know, and also to say hello to him again for the third time this week at LSE. To say he's indefatigable is an understatement. He puts the rest of us to shame. And no doubt this evening's lecture will be a testament to his powerful intellect and incredible energy. In conversation with him will be Kevin Roberts, Sir John Hicks Professor of Economics at Nuffield College, University of Oxford. Kevin taught at LSE between 87 and 99, but in between he also taught at MIT and Warwick before returning to the University of Oxford, where he was a DPhil student. His research centers on microeconomic theory with an emphasis on welfare economics and on foundational issues connected with market economies. Professor Amartya Sen, all of you know, is the Thomas W. Lamont University Professor and Professor of Economics and Philosophy at Harvard University. He has also taught at universities in India and the UK, including here at the LSE in the 1970s. The book we are discussing today, or they'll be discussing today, Collective Choice and Social Welfare, is an extended version of a monograph first published in 1970, and I have a well-thumbed LSE library copy of the book, which no doubt have passed through many hands before mine. And this book came out at just the time that Professor Sen moved from the Delhi School of Economics to LSE. It is a much expanded book, and there are copies on sale, and Professor Sen will be signing copies at the end of the evening, so do get in the queue as soon as you can. It has been widely celebrated for its path-breaking role in integrating economics and ethics and for its influence in opening up new areas of research in social science, social choice. It was also creative in its structure in that it sought to make the ideas accessible to all readers by alternating chapters of mathematical arguments with informal discussions of each topic. It is a key text in Professor Sen's work on welfare economics, for which he won the Nobel Prize in 1998. And before I hand over proceedings to Professor Kevin Roberts, let me also say that the South Asia Center, and I'm sure many of us here, especially staff and students at LSE, would like to express our solidarity with the protests and the leaflets that all of you have been handed on behalf of the cleaning staff who have been protesting working conditions. And today's discussion on collective choice and social welfare are issues that we care about and want to debate and discuss in forums like this, but are issues that we deeply care about and want to support in as many ways as we can the people who are fighting for better conditions. So over to Professor Roberts. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope people can hear me. This is really a signal event. The 1970 book, first of all, how many books have a new version after 47 years? But it's difficult now for a young audience to quite understand the influence that that book had when it came out. And almost uniquely, I think, in terms of how it changed research agendas of particularly young researchers, I think, in the 1970s. The essence of the book seems quite simple, and that is that we had the arrow theorem, which I'm sure you all know, and it had been there for 20 years. Everybody who meets the arrow theorem, I think, is impressed in some sense by it. But for a long time, people discussed it, objected to it, and said why it wasn't relevant and so on. But there was no real structure to analyze and question it. And really, it was Amartya's work through the 60s and in the book, Collective Choice and Social Welfare, which said, well, here we have the arrow theorem. How can we relax the conditions in reasonable ways? And what happens when we relax the conditions of the arrow theorem? This simple objective, I think, probably had a lot to do with why it had such an impact. Because of maintaining this structure. There were other features. It's just been mentioned. There was this lovely feature, which is maintained, I should say, in Here We Are, here is the new book, maintained in the new book, and this is the having unstarred and starred chapters. Unstarred has no mathematics. Starred is really mathematics. But the starred chapters are not the appendix to the unstarred chapters, and the unstarred chapters are not forwards to the starred chapters. There's a lovely interrelationship between the two. So you got your motivation from the unstarred chapters, and then you ploughed into the starred chapters. I first read the book, I think now 44 years ago. I didn't read it earlier because I think I was just still at school when it came out. One of the aspects of it, if you actually spent time reading it, was that Amartya laid out how you could relax the arrow assumptions, but he didn't investigate all of the implications. Some of the implications. But what seemed to a young researcher, or just a young man at that time, was the low-hanging fruit, almost. The ability, there were questions to be answered. And through the 70s, the effect of the book on hundreds of people, I would say, in terms of research, maybe thousands, was amazing. And it's difficult to imagine a book that had quite an effect upon, as I say, the research agendas of so many people. Now we have the new version. Quite correctly, I think, Amartya has not tried to revise the old version. So in the new book, you have the old book, and then you have a couple of hundred more pages, and we're going to discuss some of that. What I want to take Amartya back to is really what he thought at that time, and then what he thought was going to happen afterwards. A major part which people picked up on very quickly was the idea that social choice was about a social aggregation. We'll perhaps talk at some point about voting versus social aggregation, which is much clearer in your book than it was in Ken's original book. But we had this idea of social aggregation, and in particular the idea of adding interpersonal comparisons and whatever. And, of course, that's close to my heart. That's the low-hanging fruit that I quickly picked up. But what I want to ask you, first of all, is there's the essence that maybe everything is possible. And the same happens when we say relaxed transitivity. If we relax transitivity, which it seems very demanding, all is possible. And of course, we soon realize that all is not possible. So relaxing conditions isn't just going to allow everything. How much were you aware of that? And how much did it matter?
That's really an excellent question. I think Kennow himself was aware that the conditions were, if relaxed, the theorem wouldn't hold. And if that, what you might call mathematically tightness, isn't there, then of course the theorem is not as good as it could be. You should be able to cut it down and still hold it. But when I first started work on it, this was before I came here, I was in Delhi, and I was blessed with having, throughout my life I've been blessed with having superb students. I'm very, very lucky. If there's one thing, when people ask me, what were you most lucky with? I think I was most lucky with students. But I started teaching. I tried to teach it first in Cambridge with no success at all. Namely, I was told that it isn't the subject, really. And then eventually it was given to me as a special concession. And I'm told that when I left and Jim Merlees joined Trinity and wanted to give the same lecture, he was told that, you know, that isn't the subject. It was a special concession made to Sen, because he made such a lot of mess about that, and we had to give it to him. But it's not a subject. But I had by then understood that we could, I mean, there's some of the, obviously, the transitivity being relaxed, the arrow condition in its form doesn't hold, but something else would hold. Now, actually, I later recognized that's not true either, which I discussed in the book, that you could get weakening semi-transitivity and still have all of the arrow theorem. And then eventually, I think the big piece in the book, if there's any result that I would say is among the mathematical presentation theories, is the idea that you could get with a slight, I mean, the semi-transitivity or semi-orders generally, which applies also to other kinds of semi-orders, like interval orders, these, you don't have to change any of Arrow's axiom. But if you take the Arrow axiom by its motivation, as given by Arrow, you could reformulate it, and then I think the result, which I would say is central in the second part, is that you could get the Arrow impossibility theorem altogether without any transitivity or any other social preference condition. This became relevant. Is this working? Yeah. And I've been trying to check out of my hotel, so I'm in a bit of a bent shape at this time. I mean, generally I'm getting bent over time, but I'm even more of a bent shape now. And if, in case you haven't recognized, checking out is one of the most intellectually difficult exercises. Where is the toothbrush and what did I do with the shaving kit and so on. But since I had to check out of the hotel, I was doing all that. So am I audible now still? Otherwise I can hold it on my lap or something, no? The Arrow theorem, and I'm actually coming to Kevin's really interesting question about motivation, how much did I know at that time. But let me say something further forward, this being a relaxed discussion, that there were two kinds of motivation behind Ken Arrow's theorem. It was immediately started with welfare economics, and this institution, LSE, had some role in it, though rather negative role, I have to say, namely that it's Lionel Robbins in particular and other followers of him who were particularly taken by school of philosophy called logical positivism argued that you can't make interpersonal comparison, and also raised deep doubt about whether you can make ethical propositions at all, which are anything other than shouting, as it were. An expression Burke used to denounce the French rights of man, calling it bawling on paper, meaning quarreling on paper, or announcing on paper. But that made welfare economics impossible because, you know, if you can't compare one person's welfare with another, such issues as equity, inequality, poverty compared with other people doesn't come in. You can't make sense of that. And so welfare economics seemed to be marching towards its doom. I think William Baumol, a very fine economist, wrote saying that writings on welfare economics increasingly look like obituarial notes. And they were pretty obituarial notes. And the obituary would begin in LSE, really. And Ken Arrow was in some ways completing that. So the welfare economic, there you need interpersonal comparison, I would tend to think, definitely. I think this opportunity, since I've been very grieved this week with two friends dying, Tony Atkinson and Derek Parfit, a great economist and great philosopher. And in this occasion, I can both remember Tony Atkinson and also remember that how he brought to life the subject of inequality. But in that, of course, you do need to make interpersonal comparison, because if you can't compare one guy's well-being with another, you can't talk very much about inequality, at least about well-being. So there's that exercise. But there was another exercise, and Arrow went to that as a way of seeking a remedy of this. He said, well, if you can't do it that way, what about voting? And he... we already knew for more than 200 years by then that... we knew from 1780s that Condorcet had shown that there could be a voting paradox. X could defeat Y in a vote, Y could defeat Z, and Z could defeat X. The way Condorcet put it was actually much more elegant, to say not so much that there is a cycle, but to say there's no alternative which is not worse than some other alternative. So there is no good alternative to choose, because any alternative choose, you say, yeah, but there's another one better than that. And so that was the problem. So what Arrow did was to reformulate the welfare economic exercise, and it must have seemed to Arrow originally like a whole low-hanging fruit. And I think the big thing about low-hanging fruit is that they are sometimes not as low as they look.
Of course.
That, by the way, if I may take this opportunity of paying tribute to Kevin Owen's thesis, that he established a really remarkable result. Well, he established a number of very important results. I think one entire number of review of economic studies was taken up by you, by various articles
of
your almost. Yeah. But Arrow also thought that there was a, maybe we'll get that way, and a majority rule doesn't work, but what about other rules? And it turned out that none of them actually work. And the Arrow impossibility theorem really says that if the certain conditions are you insist on, like if everyone prefers X to Y, then X is better than Y, or X is to be chosen compared with Y, or best way of putting it, if X is available, Y will not be chosen. And then if you're comparing X with Y, then keep your mind on X and Y. Don't go on and look at what people think of Z. And there should be no dictator, such that whenever that guy prefers X to Y, then society always prefers X to Y in the sense of never choosing Y when X is available. And you could have any set of preferences. And with this totality of axioms, so that you couldn't get any solution to the problem. These are inconsistent. Now, so that was really in a somewhat different territory. It's not welfare economics, really. It's voting theory, which had been borrowed to solve a welfare economic problem. Now, that generated a debate which I was aware of, and that relates to the motivation, but only very slightly dealt with in the 1970 edition. There is an economist, quite a right-wing economist, but I believe a great economist, with whom I politically differed on many subjects, but from whom I learned an absolutely astonishing amount, namely James Buchanan. And he, whose work is referred to here and criticized even in the 1970 edition, but he made a number of points. And one of the points he said, look, if you're doing a voting procedure, why do you need an idea of a social preference? You know, after all, the arrow thing, I guess I forgot to mention it because Kevin has already mentioned it, that could you arrive at an ordering of all the alternatives so that if you could say X is better than Y, Y is better than Z, and Z is better than W, W better than A, and so on. So why? What makes such sense does it make? After all, if you're dealing with elections, you don't want to know whether Mr. Trump is a better guy than Clinton. You want to know whether Mr. Trump has been elected fairly. Now that, of course, is the beginning of another question, namely, does fairly allow you to have less vote and still get elected? But we won't go into it. If you're anyone interested in it, I have actually, this is Kevin's coffee now since I've given it to him, but it's a New York Review, along with another economist, and friend of mine, another friend, Eric Maskin, has a paper on voting analysis and goes into that kind of question. But so he said, and then he said, therefore, the arrow thing is surely not the right thing to do because, after all, we're not trying to find out what is better. We don't want to say, in this case, that Trump is a better president than Clinton, because after all, that the voters have determined what should be chosen. All we can show, given the rule, Trump should be chosen, not Clinton. To say, on top of that, that Trump has to be better than Clinton, that's like the fifth wheel in a coach. You don't need it. And then he speculated that if you drop it, then there would not be the arrow impossibility theorem. Now, I was aware of that remark, and coming back to Kevin's question, that's how we lack transitivity, and then you could get out of the arrow impossibility theorem, certainly. But then it soon became clear that there are other conditions that come up, and then I think the fusion of that I'll come to later. So I knew that this is a shady territory. I mean, this is a difficult territory. The fact that transitivity even slightly relaxed, that if you say, okay, if X is preferred to Y, Y is preferred to Z, then X must be preferred to Z. Part of transitivity keeps that. But if X is indifferent to Y, Y is indifferent to Z, X is indifferent to Z, drop that. But if you drop that, you take only transitivity of strict preference, then it turns out that you could get a result, that of a positive possibility result. That's what I did. But then there were a whole lot of other things came in, first by another then student of mine, and then later a great philosopher and social choice theorist, namely Alan Gibbard, who did that. So there was that exercise going on. So I knew that the independent condition seemed really important, and if I get a chance in this conversation, and we have a bit of time because we only have conversation, I would say why that is quite important in voting theory. and even in the such issues as Donald Trump versus others in this context. And I was not able to think in 1970 that you could drop the entire idea of social preference, which is what James Buchanan was gunning at. And eventually I did get a result, which is not unmodified Arrow condition, but an independence condition of a similar motivation. Essentially, it's a somewhat complicated condition. It's something like this, that if a collection of preferences over a certain subset S of alternatives makes you reject Y when X is available, then that rejection will continue even if the other preferences were completely modified in any way you like. That's the independence condition, really modified. So it turns out with that, and with the slight rejection, a change in the Pareto thing, instead of saying X preferred to Y, if everyone F prefers X to Y, then X must be preferred to Y socially. Don't use social preference at all. If everyone prefers X to Y, never choose Y if X is available. And there is no guy, whenever he prefers X to Y, it turns out that Y cannot be chosen if X is available. So just putting it all in the logic of choice, it turns out, translating everything properly, we get an impossibility, and there's no social preference at all in that. So that meant that Buchanan's observation was correct, that social preference may be the fifth wheel of a coach in voting theory, not in the aggregation problem on welfare economics. However, he was mistaken in thinking that would do away with the Arrow theorem. Arrow theorem does not arise from there. It took me quite some time to believe it, and if I may be slightly arrogant here, I would say that when I sent it to Ken Arrow, he told me that he didn't believe it. And he said that I will send you a counterexample. And then after about 3 years, so I said, Ken, I haven't published it, and I have to give the, I was president of Econometric Society then, I have to give the presidential address. Can I give it or not? Have you got something? And he said, well, I haven't found one, so you can go and do it. But I believe it's mistaken. Anyway, then I published it, and that was in 93, and then some years have gone by since then. Since no one has published what the error might be, I take it, it must be correct by elimination. But so what's the relevance of the result? It's that some people, when they're arguing with each other, would say that the we are trying to imagine a society in, you know, since in my student days, I read quite a lot of left-wing literature. So in Hegelian terms, Hegel was himself not left-wing, by the way, but in Hegelian terms, they were thinking of society as an aggregation. The book begins with a statement of Marx contradicting that. And in fact, in the first footnote in page one of the 1970 edition is to say what is to be avoided over above all is a conception of a society in separated from the individuals. That's a kind of anti-Hegelian statement. So people said, well, but beginning in the Arrow theorem, you are actually assuming that there is society, there is a social preference. But once you show that social preference is not needed, just have voting rules, and these voting rules are contradictory, social preference doesn't come into it. Whether you want to introduce the social preference or not is a separate thing. And you could then say, well, Trump was fairly elected, but in fact he's a much worse candidate. That doesn't change the election results as the rules stand, but it raises the question, which is one of the ones that Eric Maskin and I addressed, well, how should the rules be changed so that we don't end up in such a situation? So that is, if you form a view of social preference on the basis of individual preferences, would your electoral outcomes tally with it? So that question becomes raisable without denying that there are impossibilities here and would continue to hold whether or not you have an idea of social preference. And this is quite, it is somewhat politically charged because we are often discussing things where we have to compare what has happened according to rules, have rules been violated, did the Russians intervene in American election, in the Brexit vote, did people say things that were false, like how many millions of dollars pounds will be saved each month, which can go into healthcare, which many of the leavers said, and does that have any implication on the validity of the election result? That's a kind of propriety issue. And that issue, along with is it the right decision for Brexit and so forth, that we can separate them out and pursue each of them in its own territory, and the Arrow theorem does not stand on its own, in its own ground. You can do it in terms of aggregation and the idea of sexual preference, or you can do it entirely in terms of choice rules, and you still have the impossibility theorem. So I was pleased with that, and that was my presidential address in 1993, I guess. Even though it was published in 1993, it was probably given before that. Yeah. I did that. The interpersonal comparison, it was, again, I got immediately a result, and that was really low-hanging fruit, especially if anyone has read philosophy like John Rawls, and I knew his work well, and John Rawls and Ken Arrow and I even taught a course together in Harvard when I was visiting. I was in Delhi, but I came to visit in 68, 69. Quite a successful course on justice. It's so successful that I remember one occasion when I was flying to Washington, my neighbor asked me, he said, that what do? I said, I teach economics in Delhi. But so why are you here? I said, well, I'm visiting Harvard now. So what kind of work do you do? I said, I'm interested in theory of justice. And he said, you know, let me give you a hint. Since you are at Harvard, there is a very interesting course going on there, taught by two very famous people, Kenneth Arrow and John Rawls and some other guy. And you will find it very interesting. And I had to tell him that I do find it very interesting. The Rawls allowed you to say that, look, in any situation, you make a comparison of everyone and take the worst of guy. And compare the worst of guy in one state with the worst of guy in another state. If you say the worst of guy in state X is better off than the worst of guy in state Y, well, then you say X is better than Y, because after all, you know, the quality sympathy is quite important in this context. By the way, I'm not going to talk about this, but for those who are interested in the philosophers here, Rawls's own dissertation, senior thesis, which was written in, I think, in Stanford, which was at the time when he was a deep Christian, and it's a thesis on theology. I don't know whether you know that. It's a brilliant, brilliant thesis. It's been published later with, I believe, with editorial comment by Tom Nagel and I think Tim Scannell, if I'm not mistaken. And there is an interesting question whether this tremendous sympathy for the worst of does not have a Christian element in it. You don't have to be a theologian to get that point, nor do you have to be a Christian to believe in that point. But it is certainly very important in Jesus' thought. And so it could certainly be argued that that is a remnant of his earlier period that stayed on in the next period of his work. And then I said, if you take that, well, you can follow all the Arrow conditions, but there's no impossibility there. And this is only one example. Now, where Kevin comes in is to say, well, that is one condition, but all the conditions will be like that. what I've just now described, the Rawlsian thing, is the dictatorship of the worst of. But it could be the dictatorship of the second worst of, or the third worst of, or the 149th worst of. And as Kevin pointed out, these are probably much less attractive than the most attractive one, which is the Rawlsian one. And what remains, and his theorem was, one of his theorems was, nothing, that's all you have. So in order to go beyond that, you have to compare not only levels, but also bring in higher degrees of measurability, compare differences of differences, and so on. I had a PhD student here, then called Kaushik Basu, who did his PhD in LSE, and he just retired from being the chief economist of the World Bank and the senior vice president of the World Bank. But his thesis was on different degrees of measurability, comparing differences of different, and differences of differences of difference, and so on. And what do you, what can you get in each case? And published his thesis was published by Cambridge University Press under the title "The Revealed Preference of Governments." But so it was the exercise, and that was not a low-hanging fruit. I mean, he's being modest there, because that was quite a difficult. It certainly never occurred to me that would be true. And it turned out that it is indeed true. And that really means that you need higher degrees of measurability to get beyond that, the kind of very elementary Rawlsian point. And so that bit I had not... is there something going on? No, okay. I didn't anticipate that.
One of the features, obviously, of, as you say, Robbins had really soured things, and that ran right through until, I think, really you came along, in the sense that people didn't have the confidence to accept that you could use interpersonal comparisons. And if you look nowadays, people are happy to do this. And it's interesting you're saying about Tony Atkinson, because of course his famous inequality measure paper about a normative approach to inequality was 1970 as well.
Indeed.
So it was all coming at that time. So it kind of it freed up people to allow for these types of ideas. I just want a few words about why, therefore, you know, we often have discussed why welfare economics didn't thrive or doesn't continue to thrive in that sense, and what your thoughts are on that.
I don't know that, and I've heard explanations which I know are not true. One of the explanations, people say that the hold of neoliberalism is so strong now that you can't do it. Now, neoliberalism is a term almost entirely devoid of content. That is, when someone describes another person as neoliberal, if A describes B as neoliberal, all I know is that A doesn't like B very much. But barring that, no further information, I think, it's conveyed. So I think that's a kind of tautological way of describing it, that people don't like this kind of thing. But I think there is a possibility that lots of the descriptive or predictive work is a lot easier than something that involves such levels of judgment, and some of it has to be inescapably with some philosophical content.
Mm.
And so it could be that welfare economics is a bit more difficult, but also, I'm not sure, you see, Kenaro and I and Sam Bowles was often, on occasion, had got together in a team asked by MacArthur Foundation to say why some types of subject, there's no economic research taking place like that. And I think there's a little bit of it was Ken Arrow's idea, that there's a little bit of a bootstrap here, namely that certain things become established and you have to pursue them. And if you pursue them, you write, you know, the way American thing goes, for example, you do 3 papers on them, one of them, one of them is long and powerful, which they call a home run, which didn't mean anything to me since I don't understand baseball, but I do understand cricket. And so, but it's something like an over boundary, I would say. So you have to have 1 over boundary and 2 boundaries, and then you get a tenure. But then those who get tenure, and it was Ken's argument, those who get tenure have all been trained in this, and they give other people tenure, and they look for exactly the same thing. So he said, maybe we are over-theorizing. Maybe there is no innate reason for that. It's just that the way the culture of the subject has grown, you are rewarded for doing these works and not for doing others, and those who in the reward system go up reward others for doing the much the same. And that may be also true. I just don't know the full answer. But there's something in that, I think.
So that's an unstable...
It is unstable. It can move from one... Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Most of the... You were talking quite a bit about voting. Most of the original book would be, you call it, much more normative in terms of aggregation and whatever.
Yeah.
In the new part of the book, you return much more, not quite to voting, but to ideas of democracy.
Yes.
And the style somewhat changes.
Yes, indeed.
And this is, of course, now a reflection of 45 years on from Amartya Sen of 1970. Could you comment on that?
Yeah.
Really, where you see now the contribution of this new part, the second part of this book.
Yeah, I think my attitude to majority decision is something connected with that, I think. And in the 1970 edition, I was really trying to undermine majority rule, partly because it doesn't do interpersonal comparison, that was the main reason, but because it seemed like it could be tyranny and the minority rights may not be respected, and I had this impossibility theorem that if 2 persons give certain minimal libertarian rights, then even the Pareto principle may have to be violated. That was a short paper of about 3 or 4 pages that generated about 400 articles.
I think it was 400 within the 1970s. I think it would be the thousands.
Yeah. So I was a kind of... I wasn't a friend of majority rule that way. And I was worried about majoritarian tyranny. I was worried. And I was teaching, because this 1970, as Kevin said, came out just when I moved here. And so I was doing classes. So I remember doing these little diagrams in LSE, my classes, that you take a cake. And there are 3 guys, 1, 2, and 3. And you divide the cake somewhat unequally. 3 gets least, 1 and 2 get a larger amount. Let's call it X. And then you consider Y. Now you take a bit of the share of the cake of 3, who had the least anyway, and give it to 1, and we take a bit of the share of 3 and give it to 2. And you arrive at Y. It's a different distribution. So 1 has more and 2 has more. They, in any case, had more than 3 anyway. Now they had even more. And it's Y. And you've just made a majority improvement. Y will defeat X by 2 to 1. And it seems, therefore, implausible to me that, and this is the only respect I deferred from Ken in terms of disagreeing, that if he didn't run into impossibility theorem, it would have done anything for welfare economics. He got into it because welfare economics was in crisis. Then he got into voting theory. And then suppose majority rule did work very well. Well, then he will have to say social, from the point of view of welfare economics, Y is better than X, even though 3 has even less, and 1 and 2 have even more than did. And that seemed completely implausible. So anyway, there's a huge problem that the impossibility theorem works, but if it didn't work, it wouldn't have done anything for welfare economics, because majority rule is not a way of getting into welfare economics. So I was concerned with that, and I was also concerned that welfare economics is not a way of thinking of politics where human rights or rights of people are respected. I was concerned. I was very involved with 18th century, actually, at that time. I mean, when I was younger, I was very involved with Sanskrit literature. But at that time, I was very involved with 18th century, with, you know, Smith and Kant and Hume and Condorcet. And there were, of course, people writing about rights, including, I believe, the most underestimated of 18th century thinkers, namely Mary Wollstonecraft, Vindication of the Rights of Men, and second book, Vindication of the Rights of Woman, and then and Tom Paine, and so on. So if you bring in rights, majority rule is absolutely, you know, an unfriendly would have an unfriendly entry into it. But then there is the issue in my time, since I was an undergraduate in the 50s, was there was a pretty dominant influence of Eleanor Roosevelt-led United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that was there too. And it did seem to me that it's ridiculous that we don't have any concept of right in welfare economics or in the politics of welfare economics. And therefore I want to accommodate. And then, of course, I found that really you get into another impossibility, not only majority rule, which is that, of course, immediate. That is a low-hanging fruit. But even the Pareto principle would have to be denied. So I viewed it as unfriendly. But then what I did not fully understand is that there is a kind of context where majority rule has its way, where it doesn't get the recognition that it should get. So from that position, I became increasingly re-examining my position about whether I was being fair to majority rule. And in this, my friend and colleague and collaborator, Eric Maskin, played a part. He is quite keen on majority rule, and he is. And he proved the theorem in a fresh sister of mine, which is, you see, as I grow older, I get more and more fresh fist, and that's one of the troubles of being older. But in 95, Kevin had a very interesting paper, which I quote here, about a really deep methodological question about interpersonal comparison. But Eric had a theorem there showing that if certain set of voting restrictions does not produce consistent majority rule, then it will not produce consistent any other kind of rule having certain properties of regularity. And conversely, if any voting rule with certain properties of regularity produces consistent results for a collection of individual preferences, then so would majority rule. So there's a kind of superiority of majority rule which he established, and then the theorem was extended partly by him, partly by joint paper with Professor Dasgupta and so on. But the main thing was the 1995 paper. So that was it had quite an influence, just as Kevin's paper had an influence on my thinking. I mean, that's one of the reasons why festivals are good, because you get a reason to think about these problems. So Kevin's article was, we have not discussed that yet, but that was quite profound, and this was quite profound too. So I made me think that, okay, so obviously there is some robustness of majority rule, but is there a case for it? Now, in the middle of it all came the election of Chirac. And you remember the occasion that it looked that the father of the present Le Pen, the father of Marine Le Pen, what was his name
Marie,
actually?
Huh? Marie Le Pen.
Marie Le Pen. He seemed to be edging towards winning the election. And Chirac was pretty unpopular, but thought to be going. And the socialist candidate was Jospin?
Yes.
Who?
Lionel Jospin.
Jospin?
Yes.
Yeah. So then Jospin was made to withdraw so that everyone could vote Chirac. And Chirac, of course, defeated Le Pen. Now, take a situation when you have, I don't know what the votes were, that Le Pen gets 40, Chirac gets 30, and Jospin gets 30. So if you put all three together, then plurality rule, not a majority, Le Pen wins. But the question that occurs to one in that context is this. If you're following the majority rule, what's the problem? Ask people to rank all three. Some people will rank Le Pen top, and then whichever order, Jospin and Chirac. The Chirac people would do Chirac, Jospin, Le Pen. That has to be the case for the scenario that I've outlined, that two together can defeat, that means that they are aligned in some ways. And the Jospin people will do Jospin, Chirac, Le Pen. Now compare, follow Condorcet, and do majority rule. Compare every alternative with everyone else. Chirac gets... So, if you're comparing them, Chirac gets 60 over 40 of Jospin. Of 40 of Le Pen. And Jospin against Le Pen gets 60 again. So you don't have to drop one. You can keep both of them. You could order them in any way you like, and we would have found out whether Jospin was more popular than Chirac. So the entire French exercise seemed to be contrary to the wisdom we have got from the French mathematician of 18th century. And so it seemed to me that plurality rule is really a much worse rule than majority rule. We have to stand up for the majority rule. So that was to some extent a change of my mind. And then since I was teaching with, and Eric had thought about these issues much more, and since we were teaching our classes, and 12 sessions are quite a lot, actually. So we did two or three sessions on this. So I got involved, and I thought that my position is that there is a room for majority rule, like in that election. And I think I would say the same in the French election today. If it's a socialist candidate like Valls, and the conservative candidate like Fillon, I think, and Marie Le Pen, ideal would be not to have a runoff between Fillon and Le Pen, but to rank all three and go by majority rule. So it's a very simple tool, and the article that came out in the New York Review, and a short version that came out in New York Times as a letter, by Eric Maskin and me, explored this. And I think in some ways I also re-examined the history of majority rule. And some of the things I've been made to believe is turned out to be untrue. One of them, for example, that the Hitler problem, and the Hitler won a majority vote, and then proceeded to establish the biggest tyranny in the world. But it turned out he never won a majority vote, in fact. He got only plurality. It comes from a confusion of plurality with majority. It never had majority, in fact. So I think I got softer on majority rule, and I didn't change my view about that it's not a good way of doing welfare economics. And it says nothing at all about human rights. And I get particularly worried when one example of plurality which Indians have following the previous ruler, namely Britain, to have the system of plurality in constituencies. There you have to get the largest number of votes and you win. There doesn't have to be a majority. So Mr. Modi got 31% of the vote, but a majority of the seats in Parliament. Now, that's the rule, and so there's nothing illegitimate about that, but you have to ask the question, is it a very good rule? And then there's a further question, which applies even to Mr. Modi, then if you go around arrest someone like Mr. Kanaya in the ANU on grounds that he is anti-national. Now, your ability to describe someone as anti-national must be somewhat diminished if you have won on a minority of votes. Even with a majority or even with 90%, you should not be able to suppress people on ground of being anti-national. On the other hand, if you have a minority of votes, you must have some shame.
You were talking about mechanism. We should stop soon for questions, but particularly with the votes in this country in America over the last year, you do discuss in this book some of the ideas about reasoning and the need for an electorate to be informed. And of course, that's any mechanism is a bad mechanism if you don't have some structure of how people are informed.
I think that's absolutely right. And this is actually, Kevin, I'm very glad you raised that, because this is an understanding that become clearer to me since the 1970 book. The 1970 book, being actually 18th century in some ways, is very much took the view that if you have public reasoning, everything would be fine. But I hadn't quite recognized that how much public reasoning could be distorted by fake news and trumpeted lies. And I think the American election gave some evidence of that. I think the Brexit, in my judgment, gave. I know there are people here who won't agree with me, but I think it gave some evidence of that. The entire debate was turned around. I gave an example of a very gross misstatement, but the whole statement about what EU could be blamed for was exaggerated in a way that was very hard to defend on epistemic grounds. And so the importance of epistemology for ethics, which I knew, and in fact, the chapter 5 is all about that, this book, the 1970 edition. But that was abstract about how facts come into the values. And but of course, there are two things that happened, is that I recognized that the facts could be manipulated in a way that our ethics and politics are deeply manipulated. That's one thing that happened. And the other is that I learned a bit more philosophy than I knew from Hilary Putnam. And he had a book which I'm slightly biased because a couple of chapters are on my work, but I'm not that biased because one of them is very he said, this is my first philosophy paper. I was a research student then. And he said, why, that was mistaken. I told Killer, you look, I was a kid then, you recognize that. But the other is a very, very kind exposition of my ideas. But then he made us understand why the whole idea of a fact-value dichotomy. I knew there were problems. I knew that from many people's work, including that of John Searle and Donald Davidson, and going further back, Karl Marx. Even in his PhD thesis, most people who are politically active find it difficult to believe that Marx ever did a PhD thesis. But he actually did do a PhD thesis on Epicurus and Democritus. And it took a... It's not an uninteresting thesis. It's really an Aristotelian critique of Democritus and Epicurus. But in the process, this question comes up, which had comes up in Aristotle too, namely the dividing line between facts and... I mean, there is a division, but it's not a dichotomy. That thing. And that I came to learn more. So, and that sort of fitted in, and I'm glad therefore for Kevin's question, with the idea that really when you're debating on these things, somebody saying, well, these are factual matters. Yeah, but these are also value matters. And so I think the public reasoning, the malleability of personal public reasoning, and the possibility of making public reasoning go completely off track, I didn't understand fully in 1970, even though I talked about the theory of it in Chapter 5. And now it's much bigger to me, and it figures, I guess, it's for you to judge whether it's adequately figures or not. But I think it is certainly the case that Brexit, Trump's election, the Indian election, many others have come in. I would almost have added Philippine to it, because the president Duterte was clearly elected fairly. But would people have elected him if he knew that was murderous line that he might pursue in the context of dealing with drug trade? So there are issues, thing, and the question of re-examination. The one hero that emerges, he was a bitter hero in the 1970, namely John Stuart Mill, but he became much more of a hero in the second part. John Stuart Mill I was concerned with on liberty and the subjection of women. But in this book, I was concerned also with representative government. The representative government, I believe, is his third most interesting book. It doesn't sound like much, but if you write a lot of really good books, then third most interesting could be quite interesting. Representative government, why does he want a representative government? Mainly because he wants government by discussion. That's what he's trying to do. And representative government allows the forum for discussion in a way that a one-shot ballot, election, referendum don't provide. Democracy has to be a continuous process. And that requires debate. Now, what would have been... I was doing a podcast today for The Economist, and I was asked the question, what would you have... Oh, no, I may have... I've done so many today that I've got confused. It might have been The Spectator, one of them. The question, how would you have done... I think it was The Spectator. What would you have done? Would you have not taken a Brexit poll? I said I would have taken, but not regard to be the final word, to be taken to be a contribution to the debate, if people feel, not a very big margin, 52 to 48, feel that it would be good for Britain to leave. The question is, why? What do they think? What is the reason? And what are the changes that are needed? And are Europeans willing to listen to that? my belief also is, since I do believe in European unity very much, especially given what had happened then in Europe in the First World War and the Second World War, that I think that is an enormously important value in itself. And I think Europeans are willing to listen to some of these arguments. Instead, rather than saying, we are going anyway, what concession will you give us? And then they say, no, none, because you're going anyway, you've made your mind, Brexit is an exit, and therefore it's gone. But I think if there had been a dialogue within Britain and within all Europe, I think we would have ended with an outcome that would have been more favorable to the bulk of the British, a big majority, I believe, of the British, had that taken place, rather than just nursing that thing. And it's like saying, got you. I've got 58 rather than 48. All I do is to declare Britain has opted to go out of Europe. No, I think that is a that's a very big thing to say on the basis of what had happened. Britain opted to leave Europe on the basis of 58-48 vote in a very flawed propaganda war and a one-shot process. Where the proposition was not placed as to what. Now we know something more from the last Tuesday speech of the Prime Minister than what is intended. But even that wasn't placed. When people were voting, there wasn't a proposition on which they were voting. They were voting on some general idea about leaving Europe under the most suitable circumstances. And what circumstances among the 52 percent, there might not have been 52 different views, but there would have been at least 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 quite different views who had argued in that direction. There's a very interesting paper for those who are interested in jurisprudence and philosophy by another collaborator of mine with whom I teach a class together, also, along with Eric, namely Cass Sunstein, called On Incompletely Theorized Agreement. And what we had was an incompletely theorized agreement. And a theory, if we demanded a theory as to what is it that they're voting, I think they would have gone asunder. But an incompletely theorized agreement allows you to say this has majority, when in fact there is no theory which that has, no particular proposition which has a majority. This is an paper from the, I think, 1990s. Sunstein, S-U-N-S-T-I-N. Yeah.
We should allow some time for questions.
I think we should,
questions.
Yeah.
And Udika is going to...
You know, the less time we have and the more brutal the chair has to be, Kevin's just outsourced the job to me, which is why I'll take your questions. You're reminded to keep them very brief. You know time's running out, and we want to be fair. Please don't make comments. Ask a question and ask it clearly and quickly, please. There's stewards with microphones. Hands up, anyone with questions? There are a couple of questions in the front. Let's start with them. And I'll take about 4 to start with.
Some of us, me, have this sense that the world is coming to an end tomorrow, the world that we knew. Could you please comment?
Is it coming to an end? I think it is coming to an end, but in no great hurry, and I don't think we should try to hurry it. As an individual, alas, I will come to an end. But the world would, I think the earth is going to spin around for a little while longer, and then it might go. Is it imminent? Don't think so. And can we make it less imminent? And that's really the interesting question. Is yes. But do I remain an unrepentant believer that reasoning can help in that? Yes.
Thank you. Let's take two or three questions together. Amrita, is it okay if we collect the questions?
Okay.
Yeah. The lady next.
I think my question is related, so that your answer can be.
Related to the end of the earth, yeah.
So group them together. That is that you discuss in the book, I mean, I've only dipped in quickly as the possessor of a very, very well-thumbed copy of the original, that you discuss the extension from behavioral economics about understanding about other people's welfare, that we are fortunately altruistic. But I think, and I am nudging, I want you to consider, please, because you'll always say it so much better than we will if you do, that there is another lesson from behavioral economics that needs to be incorporated.
From what economics?
Another lesson from behavioral economics.
Oh, behavioral.
That needs to be incorporated, which we've long struggled with, which is the question of what is rationality. Yeah. And rationality isn't necessarily, I would suggest, being able to follow all the arguments that we would, as philosophically inclined people do, and that there was a good discussion of why Brexit, in fact, failed in part because the discussion was so long and detailed that most people tuned out, as most of us would. Most British elections are not so long. And in the American one is always terribly long, and therefore most people do tune out.
Thank you. We'll take a couple of questions from the back. Is there anyone further back in the middle here? We'll take those two together, please. Thank you. And then we'll get a response.
Thank you very much for your talk. I'd like to have your thoughts on this current political debate in many Western societies, the possible implementation of a universal basic income for all the citizens of a nation.
Universal?
Basic income for all citizens of a nation. How do you think about this considering the high level of inequalities and unemployment in those societies? Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, you were talking about the fact-value distinction, which is also important in economics, but sometimes quite artificial. And you also talked about, about the position of welfare economics, and should more of economics be explicitly normative than it is today?
Thank you. Do you want to take those?
I'm not absolutely certain I followed that question. Where are you, in fact?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you explain to me a little bit more here?
Yes. Should more of economics be explicitly normative than it is today, as there is often a fact-value distinction in economics that some part of economics make claims about facts, while some part, like welfare economics, makes claims that are more normative? Should more of economics be explicitly normative, or is there a distinction to be made in a good way in economics?
Okay. Thank you. I think let's begin with the behavioral economics thing. I welcome the arrival of behavioral economics very much, particularly because what it denied, namely rational choice theory. So it took the view that whatever a person is can be observed as behaving has a structure, and you can try to understand what, and then use it as part of behavioral thing. Now, and learn from it. And one of the persons I mentioned, Cass Sunstein, made very good use of behavioral economics for his theory of the nudge and so on. I think the behavioral economics does have that contribution. The way I have problem with it there is a difficulty in understanding people's behavior without much bigger, without much more probing into the mind of people. Because behavioral economics in some ways is in the, could be seen as being in the tradition of revealed preference theory. And that basically doesn't want to probe into people's mind. But people behave in ways that are not always clear. And I think the complexity of understanding behavior is sometimes underestimated. Now, for some proposition, it doesn't matter. If you want to use nudge, like Cass Simpson's use, that if you put in that automatically you pay something for your life insurance out of your income, you can opt out. That's not equivalent to you have to pay, make a separate move to make a payment in that life insurance. It turns out that many more people take life insurance under the former, not opt out, than people who actually opt in by a special move. I think that probably, as a behavioral thing, doesn't require much analysis as to what. But there are complexities, and some of them have been well known. I mean, the thing that's in my college days where people knew about a very, very, very famously stupid man. He was so famous because he was so stupid that he was, if you gave him a choice between $1 and $2, he always chose the $1. And he became so famous that people always came to see him and gave him that choice. And so it's not quite clear that it could be easily said that he actually prefers $1 to $2. So I think the complexity of behavior is, I mean, this is a very simple case, but the complexity of behavior could be quite large. So that's one problem. And the other is that it does matter how much a person has understood something. I think it seemed to undermine the role of reasoning quite a bit, namely that there could be, well, Cass's own argument about imperfectly theorized agreement. It's in the same mind, you may arrive at a compromise, you know, I want to do this, I want to do that, what should I do? And I think the behavior couldn't be the, I mean, for many purposes, including social choice, couldn't be the end of the story. So I celebrate the behavioral economics, but I also believe it to be deeply incomplete as an exercise. Now, then the next question was basic income. Now, there is a strong case for basic income, and I think the best case is made by Philippe Van Parijs in a book, I don't know whether you're familiar or not, called Real Freedom for All. Yeah, you should read it. It's an interesting book. It's Real Freedom for All, and the subtitle is What, if anything, can be said in favor of capitalism? But he wants capitalism with basic income. That's what he's doing. But it's very well argued. And I won't repeat the argument because I'm referring you to the book. But what are the problems? The problem really is that I personally am quite skeptical of income as a thing because I think partly for the behavioral reason, but I think when you have to deliver people health care and education and social safety nets, they're not just simple money given. They come with something which are being neglected. Now, given the externalities involved in health, externalities involved in education, given the risk analysis involved in social safety nets, there is a case for using money for this that purpose rather than simply giving people money. So I think, I mean, there's a strong move in India for having a basic income. And in some contexts, you do that. The Indian, the Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme is a system of basic income to a very vulnerable people who are ready to work quite hard in order to get a rather low wage, because that way you give them income which they need. And so that's the best case for the basic income. But if you dissipate most of your public resources in basic income, then that much is less available for healthcare and education and other things. So that's my concern. Now, then the last question was the difficult one. Where are you? Did you understand it?
You gave some answer earlier when you discussed welfare economics. But the essence of the content of economics is perhaps lacking in ethical considerations.
Yeah. But you see, I think the fact value issue isn't about there not being a distinction, there not being a dichotomy. Sometimes that distinction could be quite important, and people would make a proposition about something ethically has been done because the facts are something has gone this way, when in fact, as separately analyzed, you could say, no, those ethical things have not been done, and the factual things have been done, but they are not the same thing as the values involved. So there's that issue, and there's also the issue that really Hilary Putnam is about, namely that it's not so much that that you don't have independent interests in facts and values, but you can't analyze as if they are distinct, they are in divergent parts. He gave me an example, and he discusses in that book the demise of fact value dichotomy or something like that, the fall of fact value dichotomy, the end of fact value dichotomy, otherwise it's his book. And he says, he takes my example, Development of Freedom, it's a book I wrote on development. He said, you're assuming so many things are right, that this is the way to development happen, this is development, if people live longer, they have less painful life, if they have a more secure life. But you don't even bother to discuss those ethics. Why? Because you somehow expect people would agree with that. Well, that means that you don't believe in fact value dichotomy either. And I think that's the issue. I don't think this might have been an adequate answer for your question. So for that, you and I have to have a chat. But for the moment, this has to do.
I think I'm just going to get two more questions because we are out of time. There's one question in the front here, please. And then we'll take one at the back. Sorry to everybody else. So one in the front row and right at the back there, next to the wall. Can you just raise your hand? So, yeah.
Yeah, is that working? Yeah. Professor Sen, your work in welfare economics, the Nobel Prize, is hugely celebrated and respected in India. Do you think it could be equally matched up with application of some of your theories as well in India, or do you think it is matched up enough in India, the equal amount of respect and celebration?
Well, I don't think it's, matched up, but certainly have I been very effective? The answer is no. I've been, not only recently, but I've been from the beginning, from when I started writing at all. Before I finished my PhD, I was writing some op-ed article in The Statesman in Calcutta, and I was talking about neglect of public education and particularly girls' education and neglect of healthcare. And Much later, people, one of the papers, one of the statesmen, I think, asked me the question. The statesman, after I got the Nobel, actually reprinted these articles. So then said, yeah, you have been talking about the same thing for 40 years. Why do you say repeat the same thing? And the answer why I repeat it is because I've not been successful, so I say it again, hoping that this time I'll have more effect. No, I don't think there has been, but I try, I do my best, I try to do. With my Nobel money, I set up a trust called Potichi Trust, which there's a part, Bangladesh part, and there's an India part. And the India part deals with the same issue, elementary education, elementary health care, mainly analysis, because, the part of the Nobel money that got went. The Bangladesh part dealt with mostly with the issue of gender inequality, but particularly dealt with training women journalists. The Indian part has been concerned with a rather larger set of problems. It hasn't achieved that much, but it has produced a lot of reports which have got attention. So I think we have contributed a little to the diagnosis of the problem. That's important, necessary for solution. It's not adequate for solution, though. So I think there's need for political engagement on that.
Okay, we'll take the final question.
Professor Sen, my question is, how optimistic are you that the shock results in the Brexit referendum and the US elections will actually force governments and politicians, and I guess even the elite, to address the deep divisions which exist, the social divisions and inequalities in Western democracies?
It's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that. I think it is certainly the case that a lot of people in the American context, for example, I mean, the American context is complex. Hillary Clinton did actually get 3 million more votes than Trump did. And yet it could be said it could have got even more. I mean, the U.S. election is so connected with the Electoral College thing, and that's what the New York Review paper is about, that it's very difficult to interpret. On the other hand, there's no question that a lot of the things happened which could be raised no matter what the electoral outcome was. If it is the case 60 or 70% of white men voted for Mr. Trump, whether Mr. Trump won or not, that raises the question, not so much what's wrong with white men, but the question as to why should it be the case. And I think in a sense there are some issues that one could say classic issues of political left which didn't come up here. Namely, in fact, even Marxian issues of the rich versus poor. Now, Trump is hardly the right person to argue for the poor. On the other hand, he did. And if you're dealing with areas where the Rust Belt and where the manufacturing decline has taken place, manufacturing sector throughout the world has gone down. And that has been being discussed for a very long time. And people forget that Colin Clark, about 100 years ago, was already writing about that that's happening, and the trend is continuing. But when it happened, there are new unemployment, and they're not finding jobs, and then some people go out of the workforce, there is a kind of problem which is, in some ways, I think, almost a classic left-wing Marxian problem. But that wasn't addressed by the Democratic Party this time. To some extent, they were addressed a bit better by Bernie Sanders, but then again, not adequately there. So there is a need for some of the re-examination of classic old left-wing issues. There is also need, I believe, for asking the question whether the identity politics, which had been the tool of the right, had been also used quite a lot by the left by relying on black vote and you know, African-American vote and so on, and without really addressing the issue. And that and there was an interesting article in New York Times called Identity Liberalism, and it makes a good point. Whether these will be actually examined or not, I don't know. Do I hope it would be very much so? I think the same applies to Brexit. I mean, in the context of Brexit, I'm somewhat surprised at you know, 48% is quite a large proportion of the population, how docile they have been. We don't see anything. There will never an attempt to take another poll, not necessarily a Brexit poll, but on the subject. I mean, in America, we know right now when Trump gets to office, he is being supported by 40% people now. 60% are against it. He is the person with the lowest favorability rating to become president in U.S. history. We know that. We don't know the corresponding things now in Brexit. There's a kind of... I find it quite interesting that where there's a kind of lack of involvement in it. I guess the French would say that there's a... countries like France are much more revolutionary. Britain tends to have things like glorious revolution, which takes place rather quietly. But I don't think anything very much is happening quietly either. I would have expected much more engagement on that. And I find remarks like Britain has opted to vote against, withdraw from Europe. No, that statement is correct. Britain wants to withdraw from Europe. I find it as a frivolous remark, because I think, taken seriously, we don't. That requires a statement of use of language. We're kind of Wittgenstein territory now. The language use don't permit you to say that. For that, you have to say much more than a vote in 52-48 under peculiar circumstances happened. I'm really surprised how little there have been re-examination or indeed re-effort in that direction.
Straight after, at the end of this evening, Professor Sen will be in the foyer to sign copies of the new book. Can I request all of you, you've been very patient, we've run over by 15 minutes, you're requested to remain in your seats while Professor Sen makes his way upstairs and is settled, and our stewards will let you know when you can leave. So please be patient for another few minutes.
We'll make it quick.
But it remains for me and all of us to thank our two speakers this evening.